Good morning. Hi.
Hope everyone is doing well. Welcome to the first of the Costs in J. Sorry, my screen is freaking out on me. One quick moment, I'm experiencing technical difficulties. There we go. There we go. Hello. Hello, everyone. I hope everyone is doing well and had a restful and relaxing bank holiday weekend. It is indeed Tuesday. I completely lost track of days earlier this week and thought it was Monday for a moment, but no, it is Tuesday. We're starting off today with the Aarhus and Costs in Environmental Judicial Review. It is one of the breakout sessions from what was originally scheduled as a Costs in JR training session on the 14th of March. I just want to say a huge thank you to all of our participants and especially our speakers for their patience and bearing with us as we got all of this up and running again. And thank you to everyone for still joining in. I hope everyone received my email yesterday with how the session is kind of basically going to run. The speakers are going to run through their session. We're going to take a quick 5-minute stretch break after the last of the PowerPoints, and then we're going to revert back for a question and answer session. If you want to ask a question during the discussion, please do put your hand up using the raise hands features of Zoom. If for whatever reason you need assistance with anything technical or you have any questions, do feel free to either drop me an email or send me a private message, which you can in the chat. This session is being recorded. We're going to release parts of the entire week's webinar through Radio PLP. That was the handy dandy little visual you all saw when you came in. So with that, without any further, please do keep your microphone on mute if you're not speaking, just because it does create an awful lot of playback otherwise. And so without further ado, I'm now going to hand it over to Jillian Lobo, who is a solicitor with Client Earth, and she's going to kick us off today.
Hi, everyone. Yes, it's interesting times that we're in. I'm going to start by giving an overview. I've seen a few of the participants, and some of you are quite experienced, but so this may not all be relevant to you, but I think it's good to have an overarching introduction. So if we could start the slides, please, Emily.
Yes. Come on. Sorry, I'm experiencing technical difficulties at the moment. Just give me one quick second and they'll be up.
Okay, just as I mentioned, this is just a brief overview of the Aarhus Convention and how it's implemented in England and Wales. The next slide is just about Client Earth, so I won't go through this. If you're interested, there's an introduction. So moving on to the third slide, here I just wanted to sort of set out the background, the full title of the Aarhus Convention, which is very long, so we always just refer to it as the Aarhus Convention, being the city where it was, the Danish city where it was signed. It entered into force on the 30th of October 2001, and both the EU and UK have ratified this treaty. So moving into the next slide, these are the countries that have signed it. It's had widespread endorsement in terms of sign up. Each member state has its own issues. So for instance, in Germany, they have problems of standing for NGOs and people bringing environmental claims, while in the UK, the key and most significant non-compliance is around prohibitively high costs. This is particularly the case given our adversarial system and what, you know, is recognised right across the world as one of the highest cost regimes, especially for adverse costs. So this is something that the Aarhus Compliance Committee has been looking at over a long period of time. But we, although they're minor improvements, we're still not far from making our environmental claims sort of cost effective, or in a way that we can actually bring the number that we need in order to protect the natural world. So moving on to slide five. So the Aarhus Convention was established to empower the role of citizens and NGOs when it comes to protecting the environment. This was because public interest claims are those that actually protect the environment because of issues of standing, because it's a shared environment. We need to have mechanisms to allow ordinary people to bring claims in the public interest that protect the environment. Because once lost, these natural places may never be recovered. So it's founded on three pillars or principles: access to information, access to public ways of public participation, and in this case, access to justice, including the requirement that costs must not be prohibitively expensive. All these are underpinned by democracy and the rule of law. These three pillars very much depend on each other for full implementation. Can we have the next slide, please, Annemie? So, provision of the Aarhus Convention is not fully implemented in the UK. There is quite a lot of it implemented through two EU directives. So importantly, private law claims are not covered through the EU directive. So the UK has decided not so far, despite the Aarhus Compliance Committee encouraging them and noting this as a non-compliance, they've chosen so far not to take any steps to include private law claims. Going on to slide seven. So in England and Wales, the Aarhus Cost Convention claims are sort of implemented through the CPR7. And these were specifically developed to meet the EU directive non-compliance, which arose following the Edwards case. So in real terms, what this means for most people and NGOs, this is specifically in relation to judicial review. This covers the large number, although the number of environmental claims aren't that great, but they're usually focused on judicial review. So going on to slide eight. So how do you apply? Well, when you make a claim, you have to tick the box in the claim form and also file a schedule. So the schedule has to set out all your financial circumstances, significant assets, liabilities, income, expenditure. The rules have been changed, so now it is the aggregate of the financial report you receive, or likely to be provided. So you've got to think about that. There has to be a certainty in terms of that likelihood, and it has to be verified by a schedule of a statement of truth. So it is are the claimants' choice to bring themselves within the regime. Most do, but some claimants might choose not to if they don't want to disclose their financial circumstances in a public setting, which may potentially be public, or to the defendant or to the interested party. Or, and we'll look at this a bit later on, is that the financial, by bringing yourself into this regime, you're also capping the amount of cost that you can recover if successful as a claimant. Can we go on to the next slide? Thank you. So the default sums under the CPR are 5,000 for an individual, 10,000 for all other claimants. So in the case of an NGO like Client Earth, it would be the default sum of 10,000 and the cross cap of 35,000 for the defendant. Previously, under the old regime, these were absolute. So when you brought your claim, you actually knew before, when you sent your pre-action protocol letter, exactly what your likely liability was going to be. But now, this is what you can consider is likely as a default cap, but as we'll see in the next slide, the court does have the discretion to increase or decrease the default caps, but this is only if the variation will not be prohibitively expensive for the claimant. So the Aarhus Convention, the directive, and these rules are all on the basis of what is fair for the claimant, what is prohibitively expensive for the claimant. But in reality, that doesn't always play out because of the cross cap of 35,000. So the criteria that are included in the CPR are those that were developed by the European Court in the case of Edwards. And firstly, the costs must not exceed the financial resources of the claimant. They mustn't be too expensive. So this is very focused on the claimant and the subjective test. Or they are objectively unreasonable by reference to specified criteria, which we'll look at, the objective test. You only have to meet one of these. So if you have very limited finances, then obviously the financial resources would support your position. But if, depending on the circumstance of the case, you could afford, or your money is, your resources are directed for other matters and you don't want them to be used for this, you may also want to look at the objective test. In the next slide, we'll look at the criteria. So the objective criteria are these set out. The difficulty with this criteria is that they're very general. You don't know as yet, we really don't know how the courts are applying these. And basically the courts at the moment, you put in your application, so you tick the box, put in your financial statement, ask for your costs to be capped, and if you want it to be less than 10,000, or if you want to increase the defendant's cap, which is, you know, if you make the application, then the chances are they're going to cross apply to increase your cap, then how will the court actually apply these criteria? There's very little for us to know, and it's done on paper, which then makes it difficult to always understand how these criteria are applied. Obviously, if you go to a permission hearing, you could at that time put oral representations before the judge, but if it's done on paper, it is quite difficult. You would have thought that the importance of what is at stake for the environment should be a key factor, but sometimes it is, sometimes it isn't. And, you know, what is the situation of the parties? Is that moving that into a subjective test again? So it's difficult to navigate through these objective criteria. So always the safest limb is to go on the financial are they too, you know, too expensive for that particular claimant? So then in the, and also to remember that you do need to take into account in the financial test the support that you receive or likely to receive from a third party. In the next slide, so the application to vary the cap must be made by the claimant in the claim form. So you've got to make your decision really early. Equally, the defendant has to make their decision in the acknowledgement of service. The matter must be determined by the court at the earliest opportunity. This is to give some element of certainty to the claimant. Otherwise, they could be faced with a sudden increase in cap, thinking that they were only going to have 5,000 or 10,000, and then the case is too expensive to walk away. There are practical issues in determination quite early, and these are being worked through at the moment, but that is part of that is a problem, this uncertainty, which actually the Aarhus Convention and Compliance Committee view very poorly. The uncertainty creates a chilling effect for claimants. Later applications may be made, but these are in exceptional circumstances if a claimant's financial position changes significantly or if, you know, they misled in some way. And in the next slide, what I wanted to do, what more is needed. So looking as to how we can improve these further, in the next slide I've listed some of the concerns that I've sort of and other NGOs have experienced. Firstly, the caps of 5,000 for individuals and 10,000 for other claimants often exceed their financial resources, but an application to vary is so uncertain and expensive, and you're so focused on getting the case launched. You've got such a small window in order to do it. With the statutory reviews, it's sort of 6 weeks. For the JR, it's 3 months. And even though the UK government has told the Aarhus Compliance Committee that they don't rely on promptness, and obviously in EU cases they can't, but in other cases they can. They do in practice, and I've certainly had a case where they have raised the issue of promptness, and so you're so focused on getting the case issued, you don't always have time to invest in doing the work on cost caps. As I've mentioned already, a cap of just 35,000 for the defendant, it means that most successful claimants are going to be out of pocket. So you win a case. The public authority has been found to have acted unlawfully and you only recover £35,000. That's not going to be sufficient to create an economic model for many claimant firms and for barristers. And so it does in itself act as a way of deterring claimants from bringing cases. And, you know, applications for variations are more likely to result in an increase in the claimant's cap. So generally some work has been done by RSPB and Friends of the Earth in a report. And I think they identified that in most cases they are, the likelihood is that caps, when there's a variation, that it's usually by the defendants to increase the claimant's cap. Then going on to the next slide, separate cost caps for multiple claimants is unfair. The claim is usually the same, and so are the defendants going to any a lot more work in order to argue that they get numerous caps? So if you have one claimant, the defendant will have a cost cap, will have a cap of 5 or 10,000, but if they have two claimants, they'll get 20 or 3. So they'll end up with a higher cap if they have four claimants or NGOs then the claimants together will, you know. So it is a matter of how fair is that. There is the need to renew the application. These rules only apply when in the lower courts, and if you go on appeal, you have to revisit those. And ultimately, although the rules are an improvement of what we had before and other public law judicial reviews have, given the context of the Aarhus Convention, they still remain very much challenging and difficult, and resulting in a chilling effect of potential open, you know, hearings, particularly also on this financial circumstances point. If you're for certain claimants, if there is a risk, and there is always a risk because of open justice, that your financial circumstances will be discussed and heard in open court. I'm not sure if I'm then on to my final slide. Yes, and so that's just questions. I don't know how long I've taken, if I've taken up too much time, but that's the conclusion of this sort of overview and presentation. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Gillian. I think we're going to do all questions at the end as part of a big question palooza, but if anybody has something specific to Gillian's presentation, we could maybe take 2 to 3 minutes to answer those now before we move on. So if anybody does have any questions, please just go ahead and put your hand up. I am seeing no questions, so I'm going to go ahead and move on to Nina Pindham. I'm sorry if I'm mispronouncing that.
Yep, that's fine.
Perfect. So Nina is with Number 5 Chambers. She's appeared before in the High Court of Appeal and the Aarhus Commission Complaints Committee, and she's going to go ahead and talk a little bit more specifically about what we've just discussed. Go ahead, Nina.
Thank you very much. Now I have some slides, so I'm just going to try to bring those up. And does everyone see those now? All right.
They're up because I can see that you're sharing.
Thank you, Emily. I see that you've muted yourself, so I'm grateful you've unmuted yourself to confirm. Right, now I'm going to speak about a case that illustrates some of the tricky issues that arise when considering what factors bring a case and appeal within the Aarhus Convention. And as Emily said, this is in the context of a complaint communication I made before the Aarhus Convention Compliance Committee. Now, the starting point is that, unlike the Environment Bill, wrongly in my view, under the Aarhus Convention, it's perfectly clear that planning is an environmental matter. And that follows quite clearly from the decision in Venn, which I'll come on to shortly. But in that case, Lord Justice Sullivan said that Parliament has chosen to implement much of the UK's environmental protection through the town and country planning system, confirming that environment should be given as broad a meaning as possible. So the underlying principled framework for planning appeals is that the Aarhus Convention applies to such appeals. How is the government implemented? We've had Gillian's excellent talk on the nuts and bolts of that. So I won't take much time up with this, but she quite rightly said that it applies to judicial reviews and statutory appeals. Now, a statutory appeal is narrowly defined, was narrowly defined in the CPR as only applying to Section 289 appeals, being appeals typically where a local planning authority issues an enforcement notice. It applies to other notices as well, but majority of these appeals are against enforcement notices. That decision, that notice is then appealed to the Secretary of State, and the Secretary of State's decision is then appealed to the High Court under Section 289. Of course, the CPR doesn't apply to appeals before the planning inspectorate, so it's only when it gets to the High Court that the CPR provisions kick in. And also, I should say, applies to Section 65 appeals. Those are under the Listed Buildings Act, and that relates to listed building enforcement notices. It did not apply to Section 288 claims, and that's Section 288 of the Town and Country Planning Act. And those are, in my experience, the vast bulk of appeals before the High Court. Typically, those are where a local planning authority refuses to grant planning permission or fails to determine it within the statutory time limit, and then the applicant has a right to appeal to the planning inspectorate against that decision or failure to make a decision. Then subsequently, the unhappy local planning authority or appellate applicant, as it may be, can appeal the Secretary of State's decision to the High Court. And that appeal is brought under Section 288 of the Town and Country Planning Act. A judicial review, on the other hand, only comes into play when the challenge is against the, generally, against the local planning authority's decision itself. And that's because the appellant, the applicant for the planning permission, has a statutory right of appeal to the planning inspectorate. So they have to go down that route, not the judicial review route. So JRs are mostly brought by local objectors who are aggrieved by a decision to grant planning permission. That, in my experience, is the most typical scenario. So the result was, as you can see, that anyone seeking cost certainty in an appeal against the Secretary of State's decision would have had to satisfy the more onerous and far less certain protective costs order regime, whereas anyone appealing the decision of the local planning authority benefited from the less onerous and far more certain RHU's cost regime in the CPR. Was that right? No. And I will speak about this case, which demonstrates why it wasn't. And I should say complaints to the Aarhus Convention Compliance Committee are termed communications. So that's what language I use here. So ground one was based on that failure. I should say I tried to jazz up my slides with some pictures taken here in Oxford. Of course, on the way to picking up essential groceries, not going out for the purpose of it, although the purpose was actually to cheer up my dad, who's dealing with 6 feet of snow at the moment. But unfortunately, I think they had the opposite effect on poor dad. But nonetheless, something nice for you to look at, I hope. So interestingly, we can see that the government consulted on extending the Aarhus cost regime to Section 288 claims as part of the 2017 changes, but they rejected that course of action in 2016. As you can see, they didn't have very long to consider whether that was the wrong decision or not, because the communication was then made in 2017. Now, I've also pointed out ground two of the communication, but I won't make spend much time on this, because that was it fell away over the course of the complaint due to the government's changes to Part 39, the practice direction, which Gillian quite rightly highlighted, which sets out the very, very narrow exceptions to the general rule that hearings must be held in public. And there are two potential gateways now. And the changes to Part 39's practice direction was effectively Gateway G, where for any other reason a hearing can be held in private if it's considered to be in the interest of justice. But as we can see, you've got to demonstrate that first before you benefit from that exception. So I would say the chilling effect is still there, but the government has ostensibly dealt with it. Now, much like a JR or a statutory review appeal, there is an admissibility permission type stage before the Aarhus Convention Compliance Committee. Now, in this case that I'm speaking of, Communication 167, the UK fought admissibility but lost that fight. And then in response to the Convention Compliance Committee's letter saying we've granted effectively permission to proceed with this communication, they said their preferred option was to bring in legislation to deal with the issue, which was a statutory instrument to amend the civil procedure rules. And they said that was so that the same procedures, limitations and cost caps would apply to Article 9.3 statutory reviews as currently apply in respect of Article 9.1, 9.2 and 9.3 judicial reviews and Article 9.1 and 9.2 statutory reviews. Now, I can't see any of the audience, but I expect I can feel some furrowed brows. That's quite confusing language. So hopefully to help explain what that means, here's my next slide. So I have to say the Aarhus Convention is one of my favorite international instruments. It's absolutely revolutionary, and certainly revolutionary at the time it was drafted. But parts of it are hugely and unnecessarily complex. And that includes Article 9, which has more than a whiff of drafting by committee. Article 9 broadly concerns access to justice in environmental matters. Article 9.1 concerns challenges to requests for environmental information. That requires access to a review procedure before an impartial and independent tribunal. Article 9.2 then requires access to a review before an impartial and independent tribunal, whereby the substantive and procedural legality of a decision may be challenged. And Article 9.3 requires that members of the public are given access to administrative or judicial procedures to challenge decisions relating to environmental matters. So the UK government sought to argue that the cost rules in the CPR, initially sought to argue that the cost rules in the CPR did cover Section 288 challenges because Article 9.1 and 9.2 reviews under statute were included. Now that's wrong for three reasons. Firstly, because Article 9.1 has nothing to do with Section 288 challenges because those are not requests for information. Secondly, the Aarhus Convention Compliance Committee itself had held not once but twice in Communications 45 and 60 that planning appeals in England and Wales are not Article 9.2, do not fall within Article 9.2 because those are not appeals before an independent and impartial tribunal. And that follows on in a rather complex way from the Alconbury decision, where the government accepted in the course of argument in that case that appeals before the Secretary of State are not truly independent appeals because the Secretary of State is applying policy that they themselves had a hand in drafting. Although I should say, hopefully without making it too complex, appeals to the High Court can, in theory, be Article 9.2 appeals if they deal with information covered in Annex 1 of the Convention, because Article 9.2 appeals relate to Article 6 information, which then relates back to Annex 1 decision. So effectively, those deal with large-scale, environmentally significant projects. But of course, not all planning appeals or decisions involve Annex 1 projects, but as we've seen, they are all capable of dealing with environmental matters. So we know that Section 288 claims do not automatically fall within Article 9.1 or 9.2. And this brings me to the third reason why the government's argument before the Aarhus Convention Compliance Committee was wrong, which is that that is not what the government itself accepted in the case of Venn. In that case, they accepted that 288 claims fell within Article 9.3. That was on the basis that administrative matters are likely to affect the state of the land, which is a term used in the convention itself, and are classed as environmental, therefore, under the convention. And of course, the definition of environmental, as we know from previous case law in Europe, is broad enough to catch most, if not all, planning matters. And in Venn, that was reiterated and confirmed by Lord Justice Sullivan. And I should say, ground one of the communication relied very, very heavily on the decision of Lord Justice Sullivan in Venn because of this comment, paragraph 34, where he noted, and I should say, Lord Justice Sullivan is hugely influential before the committee. His name had somewhat of an open sesame effect there because he wrote the report into the UK's implementation of the Aarhus Convention. And in the light of the situation in Venn, where Section 288 appeals were not covered by the Aarhus cost regime in the CPR, he held that the results were the applicability of the cost protection regime depended on the identity of the decision maker as opposed to the substance of the decision itself, meant that the UK's regime was, in his words, systematically flawed. So you can see it was quite obvious that that was a very helpful decision for us to rely on there. And so, quite rightly, the government amended eventually the CPR by bringing forward a statutory instrument in 2019, which amended the CPR as follows. So you can see Rule 45.41, subparagraph 2A, now defines an Aarhus Convention claim to include Article 9.3 reviews under statute. So the effect is that Article 9.3 claims such as 288 claims are now automatically within the RHU's cost regime in the CPR. However, I should say that to understand that 288 claim is a 9.3 Article 9.3 claim requires the torturous process that I've taken us through earlier, which is reading Articles 9.1, 9.2, 9.3, understanding Communications 45 and 60, knowing the history of Alconbury and Venn, and of course the public are not going to go through that exercise, and they certainly should not be expected to, which is why I'm disappointed to see that this language remains in the CPR, because if I were a general member of the public, I would understand this language to say that this comprises all of the reviews under statute as defined in the CPR for the purposes of the cost protection regime. This was raised before the RHU's Convention Compliance Committee, and we have a helpful clarification, somewhat helpful. They haven't amended the CPR, but nonetheless, they have provided this public communication confirming that the effect of the amendment is, of course, to bring in our Section 288 claims within the environmental cost protection regime in the CPR. Unfortunately, they also refer to Articles 9.1 and 9.2, but the last section there of that paragraph is what's key. So Rule 4541.2 also includes reviews under statutes and challenges brought under Section 288. So after 2 years, one Court of Appeal judge, a statutory instrument, and a clarificatory letter later, communication resulted in Section 288 claims being brought within the RHU's costs regime. And if anyone has any questions on the process or some of the trickier issues that I've dealt with, I'd be very happy to answer questions on that. But for now, I think I'll pass you on to Richard, who will speak about third-party costs.
Okay, so on that note, we are going to hand over to Richard. I'm getting his presentation up now. Okay, and Richard, whenever you're ready, you can go ahead and unmute yourself and get us started.
Unmute. And there we are. Am I on the screen or not? It doesn't look like it, but oh. Am I seeable, visible? Can you hear me?
I can hear you and I can see you.
You can, that's good.
Go ahead and tell me when you want me to cycle through your sentence.
Good morning, everybody. I'm going to talk about a highly specific issue which arises in these cases. It's very interesting to hear from Jill and Nina about the general issues about AHUS and the structure of the CPR. But, you know, at the very sharp end, one deals with highly specific problems. And the sharp end that we've had to deal with and we decided to take on because it was like a fun challenge, was the issue of whether interested parties should be able to recover their costs in these claims. And if you could move to the next slide, please. The summary of what I want to say is that we were involved working for the CPRE in Kent about a local plan challenge. That was in fact dismissed. We refused permission on paper and we decided to leave it there. But we were ordered to pay £10,000 worth of costs, as I'll come to in a second, and we said, no, that's just completely wrong. We appealed the High Court's costs orders to the Court of Appeal, and they realised that it was worth, it was something to sort out. Lord Justice Lindblom agreed with that sentiment that it causes trouble. There's this case called Mount Cook, which I'll come to in a second, which has been followed, and we say blindly followed. And I'm pleased to say that the other day, well, it was the other day when we were going to have this seminar in March, the Supreme Court granted permission to appeal from the Court of Appeals order. It must be the smallest appeal the Supreme Court has ever had, but they are quite clearly interested in seeing the Aarhus Convention properly applied. At least, certainly Lord Carnwath was, and he was now retired from the Supreme Court, but he was part of the committee who granted us permission to appeal. And his name, rather like Lord Justice Sullivan's, does appear quite often in these cases. So here we have a glimmer of hope, as I put it, for better access to justice in these cases, because you do not have the spectre of all your costs cap, your £5,000 or your £10,000 scraped together, and probably which your own solicitors and counsel won't be able to use, used instead for avaricious interested parties who normally come up with enormous cost bills anyway. Now, what the Supreme Court said when they granted us permission to appeal was, we'd like to know about other cases and see how this works out in practice. So my plea to everybody listening today, please, that we need other people to contact me and let me, please let me know what your experience of interested parties has costs claims has been. Now, I know Public Law Project is a wider organisation than Environmental Claims, and so maybe other practitioners have it even worse, because not just dealing with the 5,000, the Aarhus caps, but much bigger caps. And that, and so if we could get rid of these interested party claims, that would be, I think, a very good thing in access to justice generally. I'm going to whip through now. If you could have the next slide, please, Emily. The Mount Cook was about, big developers in, it was the council, Westminster Council, and a big developer near somewhere in Oxford Street. Nobody took on board the issue of people like us, environmental claims. We tried, in fact, to intervene in that case, but the Court of Appeal wasn't interested. It, in fact, was a dispute about costs in relation to oral hearings. It was shortly after the CPR came in, and another case quite sensibly dealt with by Mr. Justice Collins called Leach. And basically, the idea of refunding, of paying for a defendant for lodging summary grounds of defence, is that the judge has some sensible idea of what the answers to your claim is, which were not provided in the previous form of judicial review. And so it was thought that costs should be payable to a defendant who went to the effort of responding and helping the judge. The trouble was that in Mount Cook, there were just three words put in there, which I've bolded on the slide, that they added the words "or other party," and that has been used as the gospel for allowing interested parties to get their costs in these cases. Nothing else in Mount Cook or Leach leads anywhere towards that, but that is what we have been stuck with, as you can see at the top of the slide, since 2003, and we decided it was time to fight back. We could have the next slide, please. In fact, the courts are quite sensible about this, but it's always unpredictable whether, in fact, interested parties will get their costs, and there's always a danger of it. There was a case called Luton, where one of the Court of Appeal judges simply said, oh, it's just ordinary principles that they get their costs, and so that was reaffirmed, and we've had to fight back that one in the Supreme Court, and indeed the judge in question is now in the Supreme Court, and so he wasn't part of the panel that dealt with it. I mean, he trusted very fair, but one must appreciate that these cost issues are dealt with by these courts very much perfunctorily. People don't appreciate how important they are for the sorts of clients that we anyway have. As I said, interested party costs can be big. We've had them up to about £50,000 just for filling in an acknowledgement of service and doing summary grounds, and it can lead to a vast amount of time arguing about them. It certainly leads, in Aarhus cases, to the default limits being used up at the permission stage, which was the case, as I'll come to, in the CPRE case. And there, in the next slide, please, we had a default cap of 10,000. The Secretary of State claimed 3.5, which is fine. Local authority claimed about 5. And the interested party claimed about 8. And so you can see the High Court carved it up by saying, oh, well, the Secretary of State and local authority, that's the first and second defendants, can have their full amounts, and interested party can have 1.5k. And we said it should only be 3.5 to the Secretary of State, and we draw attention to the underlying case called Bolton. Bolton, many of you, perhaps all of you, will be familiar with a 1995 decision of the House of Lords, which said that in normal cases, it's only the first defendant that should get its costs. And so CPRE and we decided to appeal this matter in the public interest. As I said, it was granted permission. And at the hearing, I think the Court of Appeal were astute enough to realise that there were problems with Mount Cook. And what they did was to try and reconcile it and Luton. And you know, that's the decision of the very wonderful Court of Appeal and the Bolton decision. And they introduced the approach that they recommended was to say, oh, well, the cost claims must be proportionate. And by the way, in deciding proportionality, you can also work out whether the claims duplicate the claim of the interested party, or indeed second defendant, duplicates what has been said by the first defendant. And this, of course, causes just acres of written space of arguing about this, and time taken by the courts in dealing with it, and it's wholly unsatisfactory. Anyway, we move to the next slide, please. We appealed to the Supreme Court. We said that the Court of Appeal's reasoning about Bolton was wrong. We said that it was wrong about Mount Cook. It said it failed to take into account other cases. Two Barclay cases, which we did. One was in the different cases. One was in the Court of Appeal, and one was in the Supreme Court itself, actually. And they both said, no, you don't get these. It's only the basically, the defendant gets its costs. We said that this proportionality approach that I just described didn't work properly. And we gave lots of examples of problems caused. And the Supreme Court obviously liked the examples of the problems caused. Some of which, you know, this just in this little firm, we've had lots of problems. And we pointed out how stupid this system was. Anyway, they granted us permission. As we go to the next slide, please. That was quite recent, or it was recent, and we are waiting for that to be heard. In fact, I must get on with doing the papers. As I said, the Supreme Court wants examples of the practical effects of the interested cost problem. My practical advice to anybody is that if you get a costs order awarding interested parties costs, is to get the costs order stayed in some sort of way or other until the Supreme Court comes to its decision. Alternatively, you get a sort of pro forma grant of permission to the Court of Appeal so that it can be stayed that way. I say at the bottom of this last slide, I say, please, can we have your experience? And in both AHUS and non-AHUS cases, and please could you provide details. Now, it does not matter if you came to some settlement, as indeed we've done in some of our cases. We've settled some of the cases to avoid argument. But what's of most interest is what actually happened by way of the order of the High Court or Court of Appeal, as it may be. What we haven't done is to appeal other issues that arose in the CPRE case, like the way that, and I imagine some of you have got this experience of eating into the AHUS cap excessively at the permission stage. And there's also a subtle issue of whether the Secretary of State or the Council should be the first defendant in these cases. Now, it may be we specifically avoided complicating things in the Supreme Court by appealing those points, but it may be that those will in fact get dealt with in the wash eventually. So that's all I've got to say, and I hope that it illuminates a specific example. And as sorry, at the risk of being repetitive, please help in the public interest. Thank you.
Okay, thanks very much for that, Richard. We're just going to take a very quick 5-minute stretch break and then come back and open it up to a more general question and answer. So if we could all just step out for 5 minutes and we'll reconvene at 11 a.m. Okay, I think we're going to go ahead and bring it back in if everyone is back from their stretch break. And we're going to open it up to a wider question and answer for the last half hour of our session. So if anybody has any questions, if you can please put your hand up using the raise hand feature, and then we'll take it from there. So if anybody wants to kick us off. Oh, I'm going to unmute the speakers. That could help, wouldn't it? Nick, go ahead. You're unmuted.
Right. Can everyone hear me? Hello? Can everybody hear me?
Yes, I think you're a bit far from your microphone, so if you can maybe...
Sorry.
Great. Well, hopefully, at least if you can hear me in theory, then if I just speak loudly enough, then you'll be able to hear me in practice.
There we go.
So I just had a couple of quick questions for the speakers. I really enjoyed all of the presentations. Thank you. The first one arises out of Gillian's presentation, but it may be that different people have got something to draw upon here. And that is in relation, you mentioned that quite a lot of the AHUS regime in the UK has been implemented through EU directives, notwithstanding that EU directive framework doesn't cover private law claims. I wondered whether there have been any rumblings or anyone has any concerns about what the implications are of our leaving the EU in this regard, because I suppose that might give rise to some scope for retrenchment in this context. So that was my first question. And if I can just quickly raise the second question, which arises mainly out of Nina's presentation. I suppose I wondered, are there any other obvious examples of contexts in which the regime isn't wide enough to cover important categories of challenges? And does anyone have any experience of debate around the definition of an environmental claim for this purpose in the context, for example, of judicial review, where it might be less obvious than it would be where there's settled case law in the planning context? Thanks very much.
Go ahead, Joe.
Okay. On the directive point, I've not heard any rumblings, but I imagine that that is a risk and it's going to remain a risk. But at the moment, it's still framed as compliance with the Aarhus Convention rather than directive, even though the aim was actually to endeavour to bring the UK into line with the directive rather than the convention. So I think from a sort of presentation point of view, it would be quite difficult to claw back. I think one of the greatest risks is that no changes will be made. And as a result, things will be stifled. There won't be any increases in the cross cap. And so I think that's where the risks are at the moment. But I could be wrong. I'll be interested to see what the others say.
Thanks, Jill. I agree that the risk is complacency. Nick, I'm less concerned about Brexit because the UK signed up to the convention as a member state itself. So the UK's obligations to comply with the convention exist outside of their EU obligation. So I'm not so concerned about that. In terms of other cases, I can think of where they should be covered under the cost rules, but aren't. The immediate one was the one raised by Jill, which is private law claims. I believe it's one of Richard's cases, actually, the Welsh case where a private nuisance claim went to the Aarhus Convention Compliance Committee, but unfortunately didn't make its way within the domestic costs rules. So those still lie out with the cost regime, notwithstanding that the Aarhus Convention Compliance Committee said that they should be covered. That said, I'm very happy to hear if anyone else has any ideas of
Yeah, all I can say is that
going back at some point.
All I can say is that we continue to have this frustration of private nuisance claims not being covered. Paul Stooks, who works with us, he's got a continuing battle with the compliance committee, and we have the government always turning up and saying they're going to do something, and then we've done something, and in fact they haven't done anything, and the committee produces a report saying they haven't done anything, and the government still doesn't do anything. So that if there was ever a case of kicking it off into the long grass, it's that one. And I imagine that if nothing happens in a serious enough case, we'll have a proper go at it. But that hasn't happened. That hasn't happened yet.
And I think it would be good to go to the convention and see the definition of, an Aarhus Convention claim, and it's regarding the environment. So it can be potentially quite broad in its scope, depending on the facts and circumstances of a case. But government will try to, or the public authorities will try and limit it in some way, and by arguing, and they have the ability to argue that it's not an Aarhus claim, and then there has to be a hearing over that point. But it is always, if your factual matrix is with regarding to the, has some regard to the environment, then it's worth looking at the convention and the definition of what is an Aarhus claim.
Thanks very much, everybody.
This is Matthew. I will. I work with Richard, but I was just going to mention that we just had success in a recent case. Well, first of all, there's some very useful language in Venn about the broad scope of how environmental is supposed to be interpreted, and that it's supposed to be essentially as broad as possible. And we just had success in a recent case in which we got a useful high court judgment that said that a case in which it was a case about where someone had brought a private prosecution in relation to a wildlife crime. It was a criminal matter. And then we were judicially reviewing a decision about amendment of a summons in the high court. Our permission judge had originally said it was not an Aarhus claim. And we were successful on a sort of full hearing on the Aarhus issue at getting quite a useful judgment, which you can find on Bailey. The case is Donald Kent versus Teesside Magistrates Court about how the scope of the Aarhus Convention covers appeals in criminal matters. And it has some generally useful language about whether if you're sort of trying in the end to if the underlying case relates to an environmental concern, that even an appeal on a sort of technical point, which in this case was about amendment of summons, does fall within the Aarhus Convention.
Matthew, you're absolutely right. And that just reminded me of the case of Trago Mills, and I've got the citation here. It's 2016 EWHC 1792. And that's a decision of Mr. Justice Higginbottom, as he then was, where the underlying complaint, there was no dispute that was, I believe it was a CPO decision. There was no dispute that was an Aarhus claim, but the challenge was actually to the costs award in relation to that. And so the Secretary of State said, well, this is not an Aarhus claim because they're challenging the costs award. They're not challenging the substantive decision. And Mr. Justice Higginbottom found that the cost regime itself, because that's part of the planning scheme, the challenge to the cost order was actually also itself an Aarhus claim. So that's a useful decision to show just how broad an influence the Aarhus Convention has. Effectively, the default position is that in planning matters, even in challenges to cost awards, they are Aarhus claims, and you get the protection of the CPR in that respect. So thank you for that decision, though, Matthew, on Teesside. I'll read that with interest.
Okay, do we have any other questions? We've still got 20 minutes before due to wrap up. So if you've got burning questions about costs and environmental JR, now's the time to put them. If you don't feel comfortable raising your hand, you can also just drop them in the chat and I can read them out.
Amelie, I'd be really interested if, can anybody at least, has anybody got any experience of this issue that I'd be bleating about interested party cost, or are we wasting our time? Because it's, you know, it's really important to this firm, but I just wonder if anybody else has got the experience of it.
Richard, I think there's a real issue there. So I'm very much looking forward to that being aired before the Supreme Court. You're absolutely right. The costs are eaten up at the permission stage, and it is almost inevitably the interested party who hires the QC who eats up all those costs. So it is a real issue.
Well, if you've got any solicitors who are, who are prepared to, or you can share any information about it, you know, please do, because we're obviously limited. Yeah, and anybody else?
Okay. Well, I don't see any other hands going up. But if anybody has questions that they want to put to the speakers, do feel free to drop them to me in an email and I can circulate them after the fact. I think if there are no other questions, we're going to wrap up and let everyone get on with what I am sure are just absolutely monumentally long to-do lists, as we all have in these very weird and bizarre times. Thank you very much to everyone for joining. Thank you so much, especially to our speakers, Richard, Jillian, and Nina, for your patience and your flexibility as we reworked this and sharing your expertise. If you've paid for the ticket access to the rest of the day, you will be receiving an email with joining instructions in the next few minutes from me with the link for this afternoon's session. And of course, as always, if you have any questions or any comments or concerns that you want to raise with me, please do feel free to just drop me an email. So thank you very much, everyone. Stay safe, stay healthy, and stay in touch.
Well, thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you, everybody. Bye.
Thanks very much, everybody.